he does come up here, after we can get him up here in the front, I'd like to have him open this and share it with you. This is a gift from the chairman of Summerfest. And he's kind of an emotional sort of a guy, and I guess he knew this was coming and he had to leave here for just a minute or two. So, would you join me, please, and give our guest speaker tonight, Fred C. from Vancouver, B.C., a warm welcome while he comes up to open this gift.
Hi, my name is Fred Cabanon. I'm an alcoholic. And more important, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a little gift here. It says, a gift for you from one screwball to another. Well, that's a ball with a screw in it. And it takes one to know one. Thank you. Welcome, Neil. Can anybody hear me all right? I'm tall, and if I don't speak into this, but somebody at the back, if I'm talking, just put their hand up and make sure that I'm speaking where I should be. For those of you who are at the meeting, I'd like to cover something. I'm very pleased that this is a bilingual meeting, because in Canada we have French and we have English. Here in Eugene, you have New Zealand and English. For those of you who need translation, interlake means interlake. And in Canada we say, if you're bilingual and bisexual, you don't miss anything. So there you are. I'm not sure about this box. It says Gay's Myrtlewood on here. I don't know about it. That's okay, too. Well, my name is Fred Cabanon, and I want to emphasize that I am anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films, but I am not anonymous at the level with my friends. In the book, The Good Old Timers, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it covers that very well. One night they were going back to Cleveland or to Akron or vice versa, whatever it was, after a meeting. And they had an old car that I understand wasn't working very well. And all the members of the group said, if you have any trouble down the road with the car, give us a call. And on the way back, they thought, how the hell will we call them? Because it's only Fred C. and Bob H. And who are they? You can't go to the phone book and find them. So that's why our tradition talks about anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And there's another level that I think is very important. That's your anonymity, as far as I'm concerned. But any of you here tonight that I respect that. If you want to call yourself Neil Cheney and your name is Bill Smith, that's okay, too. And that's important. I respect yours. But my name is Fred Cavanaugh. Well, a little background. I was born in an alcoholic home, and I won't go into a great lengthy story about that, except that my father worked all the way through the Depression. He was one of the few that worked. And we lived in two rooms, three boys, and my mother and father slept in one room, and we had a wooden cook stove in the other one. And we had an outdoor toilet at the back of the yard, and we had a cold water tap on the back porch. And all those bloody people in the neighborhood that were on relief, what we call welfare, they had toilets. And I could never understand this when I was young. And when I grew up and knew what the problem was, I understood it. The best way to describe my home and Christmas was not Santa Claus, it was the police department. And for those of you here who have children, you have no idea what an incredible gift that you give to those children when you give them the gift of your sobriety. And that is a great message. That is a little byplay of one day's sobriety. And after I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we were very fortunate. We adopted two children after we were in AA, after I was in AA. My wife's still a secret drinker. And she likes these big bottles of wine down here, you know. I know how she feels. And why drink liqueurs when you can drink those big bottles of wine? But we adopted two children. Our son is 27, and our daughter's 22 and still at home. And that was one of the great payoffs after we were in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking when I was about 16 or 17. I had difficulties at school with that situation, and everything was a big party and a big act the minute I started to drink. I grew up with an intense dislike for my father, and I vowed that I would never drink. And from the time I started to drink, it was the big thing. I was 10 feet tall. I could do all of the things that I wanted to do. It removed all the fears, frustrations, etc., etc. And I continued to drink until I was 28 years old. And I won't go into a long song and dance. Many of the things were tragic events. I was not a quiet drinker. I'm not a quiet member of AA. Why the hell should I have been a quiet drinker? To tell you just what type of a drinker I was, I can recall one occasion when we were returning home after the joint had closed up at 2 a.m., and we were in Vancouver's Chinatown, and some guy made a left-hand turn in front of me to drive up the lane. So I stepped on the gas and hit that son of a bitch. And I remember the bodies all popping out of their car. And I got out and told him a thing or two. He was on the pavement at the time. And then I attended to my wife, who had gone through the windshield. But she was all right. I told her father the next day when he viewed this automobile that was totaled. I said, "Do not be concerned. This girl is English. The bone is that thick, and it will not hurt her." If somebody said that to me about my daughter, I'd kill the son of a bitch. But this is the type of person I was. Everything I did was a disaster. I won't go into the blackouts. I was never concerned about blackouts. Everybody in our family had blackouts when you drank, so why would one be disturbed about these common day events? I had a friend of mine who came down to see me, and I always liked to drink with him, and he had disappeared for 2 or 3 months, and he came down to this joint I was drinking in, and I always liked him because he had class. He wore a Homburg hat, and he carried the Financial Post, that's our Wall Street Journal in Canada, under his arm, and he gave tone to the place. And even when we used to go over to one of those famous Chinese eating places that only we knew about, you know the drunks, you know the places, real special, where the cockroaches ran out of the wall and snatched up the chow mein off the plate. Then I drank a half gallon of wine and chow mein and then threw it all up. It's great. And another big evening. So he came in and drank tomato juice in this place, and he said he would join AA. And I really had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me what it was, and I said, "That's the most fantastic thing you've ever done because you're crazy." And 3 months later, I called him in the middle of the day, and he came over to see me at my place of business. That was a joke, place of business. And you see, I'd been on a drunk. I worked out of town, and I used to return home, and I had the last drunk I was on, I lost a week sober. Now, that's a toughie. I didn't mind losing a week drunk, but it's when you were sober, and the mind went, and you came too sober, and you read the call reports where you were supposed to be, and you knew you were a bloody liar, so you couldn't believe those. It was very difficult. And I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with that man. And it's interesting because he carried the message. And I like what the previous speaker said, that traveling, we heard from two speakers, one talking about going around in the export business, and then for my lady here who traveled in the United States and went to a lot of meetings. Well, he used to travel, my sponsor. I don't really call him my sponsor. He introduced me to AA. But when he went out of town, he never went and contacted Alcoholics Anonymous, and he never did stay sober. He had a year or so, and he never did stay sober. And last fall, I had occasion to go down to my auditors to see them after the convention. I apologize for being late. It was a convention where I met Neil, and I said I was sorry I was late. I was over doing some things with a convention. The fellow said, "What convention?" I said, "Well, the AA." And he said, "You're still active." I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "You know, I know a friend of ours that needed AA." And he told me about this man who sold his engineering business for pretty near $1 million. And his wife had died previously. And he said, "It took us a year to sell the business. And he took off to Reno when he finally got the money with this gal he was living with. He got to Reno, and he ended up having a fight. They had a motorhome, and he took off in the motorhome. They found the motorhome 2 days later, and he had choked on his own vomit." And I said, "Who was that man?" And he told me he was Jack Glenn, and that was the man that introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what a hell of a way to go. And that's the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? I'm one of the very fortunate ones. I love to come to a meeting and see a lot of young people out there, because I joined Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 4th, 1952. That's 30 years ago. And that's a long time. And I still go to 3 or 4 meetings a week because I need them, not because I have anything brilliant to say or impart to anyone. But I do want to tell the young people, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the youngest person around Vancouver. And I looked at all these guys my age, gray-haired pukes, I call them. And I thought the facts of life are these crazy old gang, they've had it. Because I figured anybody over 40 was a bit obscene. And you know, they had to make a deal because they were about to kick off and they were afraid that God was going to get them on the other side. Or their doctor had told them that their liver was going, or their wife had finally threatened them with some penalty, and that's why they were here. And then I thought if they had drank like I did, they would have never lived that long. And I found out most of them hadn't. They were dead. These were the survivors. And it's true. Now, if I say anything here tonight that someone doesn't agree with or it upsets you, I'm very glad for that. Because I want you to know, if you leave the meeting upset, I am going upstairs and have a good night's sleep. Because somebody doesn't like me in this room. I used to hate all the speakers. If they wore a suit and a tie, the son of a bitch was a martini drinker. If he wore jeans, I said, "Take a look. Now, there's a real Skid Row drunk, and that's not me." So I had them all cataloged, you know, and impeded my growth for years. You hear a lot from some of the people that can be classed as old-timers, whatever they are, because we're sober one day. And they tell you how great AA was in the old days. Don't you believe it? That's a big pile of crap. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, in our group, nobody talked about God. If you did, we talked to you after the meeting and got you straightened out. And we didn't read this Chapter 5 stuff. And the traditions don't joke around with us. I was in AA almost 2 years, and they said a chap was coming from New York. So I went to a friend of mine in AA, who was considered my sponsor, and I said, "Who is this guy coming from New York?" He said, "Some big shot." I said, "Well, are we going to hear him?" He said, "We don't need some clown from New York to tell us how to stay sober." I said, "We're not going?" He said, "No." So I never did hear Bill Wilson. How do you like it? Then I got some other wonderful advice. Listen to this one. They said, "Only take away the things from the meetings that you like." Well, that meant that I didn't have to listen to about that God business, and I wasn't insane. And I sure as hell wasn't going to take an inventory or make amends or do any of that other stuff. So that made the program very simple. I was constantly hostile. I drew a line down the center of Vancouver. On one side were the martini drinkers, and then the drunks were over here, and I wouldn't go to meetings over there. I live over there now, so it's all right. I wouldn't go to meetings in church halls. Let's not have any of that crap. Now, I want to... Yeah, really, it was a... And nobody told me what I should be doing, including my sponsors, because they were a little bit like that, too. But there was one thing that was better in the old days, and I want you to think about this, because this is the theme of this meeting, and carrying the message. When we had someone who we wanted to help, we knew had a problem, even if we didn't know what we should be doing, we had the language of the heart, and we sat with him, and we loved him or her in a spiritual way. I just want to cover that. In a spiritual way, without knowing it. But we did all of those things that required doing within the framework of the meaning of the word fellowship. And that sometimes we don't do today because it's a byproduct of AA being so successful. We think someone else is doing it. And God forbid, here's the real heresy. This will upset at least 25% of the people. We like to let detox centers and treatment centers do our 12-step work. Now, that is not downgrading treatment centers or detox centers, because we didn't have them those days. We used to tie people down on beds and play doctor and pour booze into them and stuff pills into them. And one guy nearly killed that. They get them pumped out on Christmas Day. I can tell you all sorts of horror stories. And so let those practice medicine who should. But let those carry the message who should. And let those do the 12-step work who should. And we should remember that, because I hear so many times people will phone up in our office and I hear comments being made, well, do you need to go to a treatment center? We're all arranged to take you. They haven't even seen the person. And this is a bypassing our responsibility in carrying the message. So I leave that thought with you. Another thing we heard or hear today is that we must start at step one and go to step 12. Believe me, it's much simpler that way and much better that way. That much I believe. However, I had such a hang-up on the spiritual program that it was very difficult for me to deal with parts of step 2, 3, or anything else that had, I thought, had anything to do with God. And I found out that you don't have to do them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's much better. I think you have to start at 1. If you don't go to 1, nothing else is going to happen. But I could deal with step 4. And I got involved in 4 before I ever got involved in 2 and 3. And I did 8 and 9. I could do something about that. But I had such a difficult time. You see, I started to have spiritual things happen to me, and I didn't know what they were. I want to tell you about carrying the message. I went to many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, how can I carry the message to my dad? Oh, you can't do that. He's too close to you. It won't work. Oh, I said. So this went on for some time, and I was in there about 3 months, and I was working on Vancouver Island at the time, and I'd gone to a meeting, which in Victoria was a very anonymous meeting. It was called a NATCA group, and I think a NATCA means is Greek for know yourself. The guy who named the meeting ran off with the group funds, and that's happened, and... When we got there, the whole evening's discussion was whether they should use their name when they made a 12-step call. So I come out of that meeting very hostile, and the fellow who's still around AA, I went back to the hotel with him in the car, and I gave him a shot at all these people on the way down, and then before we got out of the car, he gave me a shot, and I left the car, just slammed the door, and went upstairs to my room, and I said, well, if there's a God, you know, show me how I can help my old man get sober. And I went to bed, and I got up at 3, and I wrote my father the only letter that I've ever written in my life. And I had the letter at home. I've read it many times. There was nothing brilliant about it, except that I told him that I was in AA. I hoped he would stay sober Friday night when I was returning to Vancouver, because I could never remember him being sober Friday night. And he went to an AA meeting with my wife and myself, very hostile, got drunk after the meeting, called us the next day, and stayed sober 15 years before he died. I could never relate to this bastard I had as a father to the wonderful man I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never was able to put the two together. I really couldn't believe it. He looked after a penitentiary meeting in British Columbia, which incidentally was the second penitentiary meeting in the world. The first was in San Quentin in the early 40s. The second one was the BC Penn here in 1949. And he looked after the Penn meeting. And when he died, I did his estate. He had $863 counting the value of his old car. And over 400 people came to his funeral. And it was an incredible experience for me, and he was a wonderful person. And I had a great example of what a person was like drinking and all the horror and the nightmare with it to what a person could be sober. I want to say my wife went to my first AA meeting with me, and my wife's here with me at my last AA meeting. She's right here in the front row. And she's been with me at all our meetings pretty well since then. And so it's been a family program in our home. I never realized after that prayer that I put up, if, you know, God's up there, get with it and show me what should be done. And that happens. So watch out what you ask for, because you can ask for it in any way. You will probably get answers, and I was so, my mind was so clogged up that I didn't understand that I had received an answer to a pretty poor way of praying. I was in the Canadian Army in 1943, and I used to think that we were making a mistake. Don't want anybody to get offended at this, but I used to think we were making a mistake. They're trying to shoot the Germans in Italy. We should swoop in and get them all in the Vatican. Yes, that rotten bunch in there. Now, mind you, I wasn't a Catholic, and I never, you know, I wasn't a Protestant either, so don't be concerned about that. I just was mad at everybody, particularly in the religious field. That's how my mind worked. Then I got all confused about the spiritual program with things religious. And people said to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, well, you know, you've heard this one, I'm sure, about, you know, electricity is a bigger power than yourself, or a doorknob or something. I looked that up in the book, and I couldn't find where it said, came to believe that a doorknob would restore me to sanity. And there's nothing in there about, you know, electricity either. So after a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did come to believe. Now, for any of you in the program, that's very important to understand in the second step, because I was years before I understood this. It doesn't say, come to believe after 10 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't say, come to believe when the sponsor tells you you're supposed to believe. It doesn't say you're going to get hit by a spiritual lightning bolt in the bathtub. Nothing. It just says, come to believe. I can't tell you when and why it took so long for me, or why you may be able to grasp it, or perhaps you come into Alcoholics Anonymous with a spiritual foundation, which is marvelous, to restore us to sanity. It says could, didn't say would. That's for you, Neil. Because anybody that takes the chairmanship of one of these things is a little bit, you know. Although Dixie told me that Neil has been calm and serene all week. He's just shouted, told Dixie what to do, and then left the house. So it's all right if you go a little crackers. And I'll illustrate that with a point. It was 2 years ago now, but I'm driving off to a Sunday morning meeting, and it's a beautiful summer day, and I'm driving down this very wide street. There's no traffic. And I arrive at the stop sign, and some guy pulls up alongside of me, and he's windows down, his wife, I guess it is, on this side, and he's really going at me. And I couldn't hear him over the motor and so on, and so the light changed, and we went down about 3/4 of a mile to the next night, the light, and we stopped the car, and I'm trying to hear him. I say, "What did you say?" And he's going right at him, and I can see he's very disturbed. I didn't know what I did to him. I cut him off or didn't see him anyhow. Now I'm getting a little annoyed. So we go to the next stoplight, and I'm this far from him. Now, this is Serenity, 28 years sober. And I said, "What did you say?" And he started off again, and I couldn't get it all. But I fixed him, because I've been restored. I just reached out and bent his aerial down. And his wife said to him, "He's crazy. Get out of here." And they took off. So I went to the meeting that morning, a spiritual meeting, of course. And I thought, what the hell would I do without AA? He was very fortunate. If I had been drinking, I would have run him right off the road. I don't do that too often. Particularly in Oregon. The last two times we were down here, I got two tickets on the same day and didn't please me. And in many of our steps, there are little words that I was around AA so long before I understood the meaning of them. And they really, if they took them out, they wouldn't have complicated this program for me. Things like "entirely ready" in step six. Now, they just said "get ready." It would have been all right. But the trouble is they said "entirely ready." And then they could strike off "humbly." You know, just ask them to get there, but not "humbly." You know, that's very difficult. And "promptly." How do you like that one? "Promptly." Everybody put up their hand that knows what "promptly" means. One person put up their hand. "Promptly admit when you're wrong." I was in Alcoholics Anonymous 20-some years, and one night I heard the 12 Steps, Chapter 5 being read, and I thought, I've never heard that word before, and this was one of the great difficulties I have had, has been Step 11, shot through prayer and meditation. You know, my idea of prayer had been very difficult, what to pray for, because I don't understand things that go on in the world, in the universe. I find great difficulty. Somebody tells me in AA and outside of AA that they're part of God's wonderful plan. And I think when I see people starving to death or being slaughtered with bombs and other things that go on in the world, and I think, what the hell has that got to do with a marvelous plan? And I find it very difficult to figure out what to do sometimes. And in this 11th step, they talk about meditation, which I've always associated with a guru from India on a bed of nails, which didn't really turn me on. So I've associated them with men's discussion group, where they get very esoteric and all have spiritual flashes. But the person talked about the word "only." It says, "Pray only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out." And like a flash, the whole thing has been made so simple. And all of my revelations in AA, the things I found out of it, I've always come back and they're so simple. And I guess this is the reason that I've missed them. It doesn't say that I'm going to pray for my sobriety. And I don't have to pray for your sobriety. And I don't have to pray for my health or my wife's health or my father-in-law or mother-in-law or anything else. I don't have to pray for peace in the world. I don't have to do anything. I just have to do one thing. I pray only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. And that is so simplified, my approach or my spiritual involvement in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The theme of our meeting, of course, is the carry the message. So I think it's very important we heard about somebody carrying the mess instead of the message. I like that. I have never heard it put that way. But we are postmen, or post ladies, as the case may be, mail carriers or whatever the term is down here. We only deliver the mail. And if somebody gets our message and thinks it's junk mail and throws it out, that's not the postman's responsibility. He just delivers the message. That's all. That's all we have to do. Make sure we deliver the message. And how do we deliver this message? A fellow came to our meeting one night and he got up and expressed his great gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous because he'd had a great example of alcoholic work. That the family next door to him had all fled to his house, the wife and the children, because the man had a shotgun and was going to blow them all apart. And the cops arrived shortly thereupon afterwards and disarmed him and removed him. And he gave us a heartwarming talk, and we all wept, and the violins played, and it was marvelous. And I said to this man afterwards, "Have you told him about Alcoholics Anonymous?" He said, "Well, he's my neighbor." But how many of us in this room know somebody that has a drinking problem and we have not told them about our involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous and that there's a way out? And I'd like you to think about that one. And you may think, "Well, God, I can't do that because she's a member of the Bridge Club." Or, "I can't do that because we go to the same church." Because the Christians drink too, I found out. In fact, when I look out here, I'm sure there's lots of Christians here. And you can't tell the Christians from the alcoholics. No. And all they can do at the Bridge Club is tell you to go to hell. And if you were a drinker like I was, you've been told that before. I found this out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you another personal experience. I believe this now. If I know somebody that has a problem, I just don't rush in necessarily and tell them. I try to pick a time. And how do you pick a time? Well, if you believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I now do, you tune into the power as you understand him, and you'll know when to go and tell them. Now, that sounds, if somebody had told me that when I first came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have thought they're, you know, a little odd. I had a recent case of a man I've known for many years, and I knew he had an alcoholic problem, and I've got all the background on it and from him and his wife. He didn't know I was in AA. And I said, "When the time is right, I'll go and tell him." So I'm driving past his place of business one morning. I was going to my office and expecting a call which had been prearranged from Germany. And there's nobody else in my office but me. I'm a consultant. And so, you know, it was prearranged, and I'm there, and the call was to come at 10 o'clock. And as I drove by, I said, "This is the time." I stopped the car and went in, and I told him about Alcoholics Anonymous. He drank for the weekend, phoned me Monday after seeing the doctor. And the doctor said, "If your friend tells you you're an alcoholic and you should go to AA, you better do that." And the doctor gave him some Valium, and when I found that out, I said, "Put it in the toilet." So he went back to the doctor next morning, and the doctor said, "If your friend says put the Valium in the toilet, put it in the toilet." How do you like that? Somebody is telling these doctors something. The point is that I had tuned in. Now, that is a true story. I'm not here to tell you any lies. That happened. So if you are ready to do something about it and you will really make yourself available, you will know when to go and carry the message. We carry the message when we stay sober at work. We carry the message when we are at home. And this is a little message for you. If you want to judge your sobriety, ask yourself this question. Are you fun at home? Last Wednesday night at my own group, some people assembled, a couple of hundred people, and I had a birthday cake because that's something we do up there. And a couple of people got up and said some nice things about me, and my wife leaned over to me and said, "You know, they're not married to you." Years ago, my son took a picture of me as I got out of the garage when Daddy arrived home from work. And I was approaching the house. I'm going to tell you, if anything like that approached my house now, I'd shoot it. Now, I had been all day that successful, dynamic president of the company. I was smiling and, you know, and all that stuff, and I was approaching the house. And, you know, that's how we are. And that's a great way to judge sobriety. And I learned that from a man who I met when I was first in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was in about 3 months ahead of me. He went to grade 3, one of the wisest men I've ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous, or ever met, period. And that was his great thing. Are you fun at home? And, you know, it's a devastating comment on our sobriety. And I find it still very difficult to be a human being in my own home, to not be picky, to express the love that I feel for my wife and my family. That's been very difficult, and I think it perhaps goes back to the battles that used to go on in my own home. And it isn't the way I feel inside, but that's the way it comes out sometimes. And that's what the way I continue to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to find out how to live and to carry this sobriety message, not only in AA, but in other areas of my life. We go through phases in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been in a program, as I told you, a little while, and I've never spoken at a convention before. I've been asked to a couple of times, and I have not done it because I was in the merchandising business for years, and I could get up and give a planned talk and tell you how I was struck with a lightning bolt and all these marvelous things and put it all together. And I decided that if I did speak at a convention, and I would speak, but I wouldn't plan what I had to say any more than I would if I was called up to speak for 5 or 10 minutes. And you're probably aware of that now because this thing has lost its track. And I say that for a reason, because I want to speak how I really feel today. Now, that can be very hazardous because some days I'm not where it's at. But that's how I would have to address you, how I feel right now about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not how I'd like to feel, not how I'd like you to feel, not to say what I think you want to hear. I want to tell you, as my Greek friend used to say, from the heart. And I hope I'm doing that. There's many people that I think perhaps newer people will be confused. They will get quantity mixed up with quality. See, quantity of sobriety has nothing to do with quality, as my bending of the arrow will demonstrate. But can I say this? It's a lot better being sober for a long time, one day at a time, than just being sober sometimes a few days, because you now know where you go off the rails. You know what to do about those things. You played the record before, so you don't have to put it on again because you don't like the music. And the second thing is that it is a demonstration that you can live sober one day at a time for the rest of your life, and that most of the time you can enjoy your sobriety. there's a couple of things I've observed, and these are facts, they're not judgments on people, is that those people who stay sober, and listen to this, this is a very great, very simple, you see, this is the type of message I missed. Two things. If you go to meetings, just stay sober. That's a real message. And for those of you going to one meeting a week, lots of luck. There's a fellow stayed sober in Vancouver for about 25 years, and he goes to one meeting a week, and I get it to him every time I see him. And I said, God damn you. He said, I stay sober just as the rest of the guys. I go to one meeting a week. And I said, you act like it. One of my qualities is gentility. Suave, somebody said. But say it like it is. We go through periods in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the first couple of years we're in AA, it's really a revelation. You're eating breakfast instead of throwing up last night's spaghetti. You're waking up and you cannot understand why your head isn't pounding. You're actually paying bills. You're not writing strange checks. Yeah. I spent $3,000 in 1952 in my last 10-day drunk. How the hell is this possible? They loved me. I was a big shot. You know what I mean? My wife's a musician, and we both worked, and we were making reasonably good money in those days. It took us 2 years to get out of the hole. And I got a bonus, $900. Do you know what that means? You know, $900 in your pocket, the old feeling? You know? I'm on top of the world. And so I went to an AA meeting, and I got, when I came out of the meeting, I picked a fight with my wife. But she wanted a stove. She had a hot plate. What the hell more did she want? So I went over to a friend of mine had the same name as me, Percy Cavanaugh. All the Cavanaughs were drunk. He was no relation. But he was a longshoreman. They should have never named him Percy. The wrong guy. So I knocked on his door and at 2 in the morning, and this was quite common in those days. For some of you who have been around a while, you'll know what I mean. I knocked on his door. And he said, who is it? And I said, it's Fred. He said, what do you want? I said, I'm going downtown to get drunk. How about coming along? And he said, that's a hell of a good idea. If you got a good reason, we'll both go. So I went in and told him my reason. And then my wife got a stove and a fridge next day. You know. Wasn't that typical of that generation that I lived in, for the young ladies here, to think that even after we sobered up, that we dispensed all good things to the wives and the women. What the hell did we do? Who did we think we were? It's really quite remarkable, you know. But that's the way it was. I went in another time talking about going to, if anybody travels and you're not contacting AA with Coral Island, and I have to be very careful. Hotels depress me. Not all hotels. This hotel doesn't depress me. It's a very nice room and a nice hotel, a nice atmosphere. How could it be otherwise with all the great people here? But I do a lot of traveling, and I have to be very careful, because I go into a hotel room that isn't right, I immediately become depressed. And I understand that, and I just get out of that hotel or that room, that's not right for me. And that's one of the strange little things I have. And I was in Port Alberni, which is on the west coast of Vancouver Island, and it was October, November, and the fog's coming in, and the joint was all depressed, and I'm in a rotten hotel, and I went downstairs and they opened the beer parlor at 6:30, and I went in and ordered 10 glasses of beer. Well, there was nobody in there but me. And that's, you know, not one or two, but bring me 10. And I looked at the beer, and it was only 10 cents a glass in those days, and I had 10 of them. And I thought, this is crazy. So I went out in the lobby and got in a phone booth and phoned a friend of mine up. And I said, do you remember me? He said, yes, of course I do. He said, where are you? I said, well, I'm in the beer parlor. He said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm nothing yet, but I've got 10 beers. He said, have you drank any? And I said, no. He said, don't get out of the phone booth. So, so I stay in the phone booth, and the waiters are looking out, you know. There's this guy who's ordered 10 beer. And after about 5 minutes, you could hear his car barreling down the road through the fog. And he tore up to the door, and I was all right. And I met somebody today from Everett. Lovely lady that's here. Terry, right on the end. And I've lived in Vancouver. Never been to an AA meeting. In Everett, Washington. But I joined AA, as I told you, on the 4th, which was a Friday. And on a Saturday, we had planned to go with my mother and father-in-law and my wife down to Everett. I can't remember what the reason was. But I said, no, we were going. And we drove down. And that, you know, that short, that first day, and I'm just, you know, way out there somewhere. And I'm just ready to jump out of my skin. So they went shopping, and I said, well, I've got to do something. And my wife said today, she thought I'd gone and got drunk. And I phoned up AA, and I said, I've got to talk to somebody. So some guy who I don't know the name, his name, I couldn't remember him, what he even looked like, he came down and talked to me for an hour in the car. And you know, I'll bet you that guy said, Junior, there was a crazy guy down from Vancouver, and that was a waste of time. How much he helped me, we'll never know. Because I may have gone and got drunk, and he carried the message. And we carry it sometimes in strange ways and never understand what we do. I want to leave a great thought with you here, and this is really profound. Don't laugh. It is really profound. Everybody in this room, everybody, even Al-Anons and everyone else associated with this problem. And we had no Al-Anons when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started non-AAs. I said, what the hell is that? And some guy said, it's Neurotics Anonymous. Well, I said, we don't need them. And anyhow, what a marvelous organization that is today. And it's great to see this. Meetings that are run together like this. Now, what was I talking about? Profound! That was the word. Thanks, Neil. Yeah. Every one of you out there has, if there's some other person drinking out there that only you can help. I want you to think about that. If I can leave this thought with you, I'm not going to stop after this, so I've got 5 minutes yet. But I want to leave this thought with you. I can't help that person. Neil can't help that person. The chairman, in spite of his red jacket, can't help that person. No one can help that person or carry the message but you. Because you have the key, the magic word. You have whatever it is. And if you are not practicing the principles in AA, and you're not practicing the 12 steps and carrying the message, the person will never be helped. And they may die drunk and affect all those other people. And only you have that magic word. I've had so many people come up to me over the years and said, well, you know, I really have difficulty, and I don't know what to do about carrying the message and whatnot. And now there is a time to really sit down and tell the person what they can do, how they can carry the message, and only that person can carry it. And if every one of us left here and we're at the ready, we accept the responsibility that only Fred can help some person out there. I don't know when it is. It might be today. It might be a year from now. It might be next week. But only I have that magic word to help them. Let me tell you another true story about the magic word. My brothers were all American. They were born down here. They're all dead. My last brother to die died in Seaside, Oregon. And he phoned me, and I never heard from my brother unless there was trouble. And he phoned me, and I knew there was trouble, and I drove down to see him. And he had started with a simple skin cancer. And he had gone to a crack and spent all his money, and that should have been a simple thing to cure. He now had a serious mess in his head. And I brought him down to Portland immediately, and the doctors examined him and come out and said to me, you know, this is a tragedy. that there's nothing we can do, and he died about a few months later. And he was another product of that alcoholic home. He wasn't an alcoholic, but I won't go into the details. But I went down for the funeral, and there were five of us there in Seaside, Oregon, at the funeral. And I returned to Vancouver, and I went to an AA meeting, and I spoke about the sad thing in my life, and I said I was joyful to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't say that I'm happy about everything all the time, because any person who's happy all the time is crazy. Who all can be happy about the things that are going on in the world? Who can be happy about tragedies we see in other people's lives? Who can be happy about health problems and a lot of other things that can take place? But I can be joyful about my sobriety. And a man gave me a medallion on my birthday, and he just celebrated his seven-year cake. And those words that I said, and I would have never remembered saying those words at that little meeting I attended that night, but he had been horsing around and screwing about with AA then for a year or so, and disastrous results. And those words, those simple words, and they seem so ineffective and ineffectual when I say them now. And yet he tells me time and time again about the magic words when I said I was joyful about my sobriety. So, you know, we have a message to carry, whether it's at AA meetings, if we're asked to speak, whether we do things in our group, whatever. We go through these periods in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I call them. Oh, this will get somebody upset. And that's good, because you're upset, you'll have to stay for the meetings tomorrow, which means you're guaranteed another day's sobriety. And remember, I'm sleeping well. Because geez, that used to burn me up. I used to get so mad at the speakers, and I knew they were home sleeping. Man, really got to me. What was I talking about, Neil? I'm doing all right, am I? I'm lost, you Neil? Good. Carrying the message, whatever it was.
You were going to screw up 25% more.
Yes, I'm going to screw up 25% more of the people. That's okay, too. There are periods in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was reminded of this morning when I was talking to someone. It was afternoon outside, and they're here somewhere. I've forgotten who it was, but we were chatting about periods that we go through in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the first couple of years, you know, there's the marvelous things that are happening. As I say, we're cleaning up our act and everything's great. And then we enter what I call the service period. You know, the type, I never knew what sobriety was until I was in service, you know? So they work a couple of years and they go to all these committee meetings. Sorry about that, Neil. They're getting all organized in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then they quit. Where the hell do they go after 4 or 5 years? I don't know. And that's a very dangerous period in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm saying this, I call it the 5 and 10 year syndrome. I'll deal with the 10 year syndrome in a minute. But the 5 year, watch out for it. If you're in 4 and 5 years and you're going to meetings, and you think, what the hell am I really doing here? I've done it all. You know, I've worked in service down at the office, and I've gone and 12-step calls, and I'm paying my bills, and I'm a great guy now, and I'm fed up listening to all this stuff, really, you know. Watch out. It's a very dangerous period. I think it's a period that I found I had to rededicate myself, and nobody told me about this, and then when I started to talk about it, all kinds of people came up to me and said, God, why didn't somebody tell me about this before? Because after 5 years, if we go back drinking, I don't believe it's a slip. It's a disaster. After 5 years, I find that when people go back drinking, there's a hell of a great problem coming back to AA. I don't know what the percentage is, but I know it's minimal compared to having difficulty when we first come in. It's understandable when we first come in, the way we're mixed up. Because we all have slips, you know. I told you about 2 slips I had, but I knew what to do about them. I didn't drink. I ordered the beer, but I didn't drink. But the whole thing had gone to hell, and I had gone to meetings in that town, and I got on the phone, and somebody carried the message. They didn't say, well, I'm sorry, I got to go bowling tonight, I got to go to the church tonight, because I'm a respectable drunk now, and I hadn't got time to get out in this gutter of the street anymore. Sounds like a men's discussion group. Sorry about that. I'm just doing a little kidding. We have a little kidding going on about that up in our area. So in carrying the message, it's important we tell people at 4 or 5 years, I think, what can happen. And at 10 years, I don't know what happens, but the dropout at 10 years is also around that. It might be 8, 9, 10, but you know, I call it the 10-year syndrome, where there seems to have to be a rededication to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I think if you see a period coming up like that where you start drifting away from Alcoholics Anonymous, that doesn't mean everybody that leaves AA goes and gets drunk. A lot of us would like to think that happens, but it doesn't happen. But I believe you're playing Russian roulette. How many people here have been in a house fire? Put up your hand. Who's been in? Look at that. I see about maybe 20 hands and you've been in a fire. Now, everybody put up their hands that carries fire insurance. Well, everybody carries fire insurance in case they have a fire. That's a hell of a good reason to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You might have a fire. And if your insurance premium isn't paid up, you know, you can't collect on your sobriety. It just won't work. We talk about the principles in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's three or four principles that I'm going to deal very quickly with that I think are important in my life. One is honesty. It's how we come to the program to find out, to look at who we really are. It runs through our fourth step. It runs through our tenth step. It is through them all. But that is a principle. The principle of being honest in all my affairs. That means your business affairs. That means with your family affairs. It doesn't mean having an affair in AA. That's important. I look rather sad. I've only been married once up here. I've been married 4 or 5 times, but I've only been married once. I don't make calls on the women in Alcoholics Anonymous unless I have to. That's important. Women should go call on women. Men should go call on men. If you have to go make the call, take somebody else with you, so we don't all get fouled up, or we'll foul up somebody else's sobriety. There's a principle of being, I call it my spiritual principle. I've touched on that throughout my talk, I hope, today. It's that principle of being in touch with the God as I understand him. And I'm plugged into that, I think, now as reasonably well as I can be, and still growing, I hope. There's a principle of humility. Nobody wants to talk about humility in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why is everybody afraid to talk about humility? Humility, to me, is being teachable. That's all. There's 7 steps and 7 words, and the word is humbly. Why is that separate step, which is only 7 words, it's so short, and it says, being humble. And that is being in tune with God as I understand him. It's also to do with anonymity, not the kind that my name is Fred C. or Fred Cavanaugh or whatever it may be. But it's doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was my dear friend, the Ross O'Brien, my friend that made the remark about our fun at home, said, if it's worth talking about, or bragging about, or whatever, it isn't worth doing. You just do it. And I believe that these are spiritual conditions of humility, and you're teachable, and you can grow at that time. I have experienced that in Alcoholics Anonymous briefly. I really mean this sincerely. Briefly, at times when I knew I had been at one with the source of everything. And then it's gone. It's a fleeting thing, because I'm a very imperfect person. And no one among us can practice anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Not the steps, the principles. And then this leads us really into the great principle which is what AA is all about, is the principle of love, of being able to love someone, regardless of who they are, whether they're a friend of yours. You see, we all love our friends and our wives and our children and all those things. Can you love your enemy? I had occasion to go to a lawyer yesterday before I came down here to possibly start a slander suit against somebody. Isn't that something? And the fellow said to me about what this fellow said. I mixed up in some political things. And I said to the lawyer, you must understand one thing. I wish this man no harm. I wish him no evil. All I want him to do is stop the remarks. He said, well, you have affidavits here. We can take it to court and collect some money. I said, I didn't say that. I said, I'm not mad at the man. I don't wish him any harm. He'd spent years working on, and it's been shot down in flames. I said, just tell him to desist and stop it. Now, that would have been different than the old days, because Ron punched him out. But I say this as a demonstration. You must love everyone. I believe that, if we are to stay sober in this great program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In conclusion, I'm over time, 2 minutes. In conclusion, if you're practicing the love, then you're carrying the message. You cannot escape doing that. One follows the other as day follows night. You cannot practice the principles without carrying the message. It will be the focal point of your whole life. It will be your reason to be. It will be the thing that makes life perfect for you and those around you. You don't have to talk about it or do anything about it. You just have to accept it and know that that's what you should be doing. And isn't that a wonderful gift that each one of us have here, knowing that we are carrying a message that no one else can carry, and that there is someone out there that only I can help, that only you can help, and we must always be at the ready, and we accept that responsibility. For that, I'm very grateful. I have only all good things to say about being asked to come down to the convention here and speaking, and it's great to know all these wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you all stay part of my life and my wife's life one day at a time for the rest of my life. Thank you.